Okay, so the last time we talked, you said something. You said, look, at the Knot, we optimize for decision making rather than process. So let's start at kind of the highest level. What does that mean?
First, I think it was, I believe I said it in response to a question from an audience member to a panel that we were doing about, how do we optimize our processes at The Knot, right? And my response was that we don't necessarily focus on optimizing the process, but rather the decision making. So what does that mean? First of all, I feel like I do need to start by softening that and saying, like, it doesn't mean that we don't have any process. We definitely have some process, but where I think like optimizing the process means ever tweaking and ever more prescriptively defining the steps of the process in an attempt to make the process more accurate. We are more interested in how light can we make the process so that it still provides the kind of necessary, guidelines that allow a group of people to organize and do anything together. But not so much that the process ends up impacting the quality of the decisions that we make. And what I mean by that is, so what does it mean to optimize for decisions instead, right? Fundamentally, I think of a process as something that like attempts to answer the questions of who does what, when, and with whom, and maybe covers also what is sort of the output of that work, right? If you lock that down too much, you are pretty much setting yourself up to be working with incomplete information and making the wrong decisions, right? Because, I think things that I'm about to say apply equally to sort of like tactically planning how we're going to build a specific feature for which we have a very clear idea, as well as like planning what we should focus on next quarter or next year, right? Which is to say that like you're looking at a bunch of different options and you need to evaluate those options and pick the one, two, three that you're going to prioritize and focus on, right? And for each of those options, you need to understand, what is the possible impact of doing this? What is the good or bad it's going to do to our customers? What is the good or bad it's going to do to our business? What is it going to cost us to do this? What is it going to cost us to do this now? What is it going to cost us to maintain it later? So on and so forth, right? And to get to the answers on those questions, there's a high likelihood that you need to talk to different people about different ideas, right? I think it's fair to say that like 80% of the time, like your core team is there. There's a product person, a designer, a tech lead. There's probably a handful of the same engineers that kind of run with you quarter after quarter. And so there is a perception of stability in that process because 80% of the time you're talking to 80% of the same people. But it's so important to remain flexible and to recognize that like sometimes you'll be asking a new question and nobody on your team knows the answer and nobody on your team is the expert. And suddenly, in that moment, your process needs to involve a completely new who, a completely new what, at a completely new, not previously scheduled or planned time or possibly context. It might be a person that's inside your company on a different team. It might be a person that's not even inside your company. It might be, doing user research and talking to customers, or it might be hitting the road and talking to like, I don't know, a couple of like product leaders at another company that have solved a similar problem, right? And so if you say focus on optimizing the process, right? Like what does optimization usually mean? Increased clarity of process and reducing likelihood that like you're going to make a mistake, take the wrong step, right? Waste time talking to the wrong person. Well, guess what? Like, of course, you need to waste time talking to the wrong person. You need to talk to 10 people about something, and four of them are incredibly insightful and useful. But you get to them via the six that were like, yeah, we didn't figure it out either. That's a tough one. Can you call me back at the end of this roadshow? Like, if you find out something,
And so that's interesting, right? So one of the challenges that lots of organizations get into once they commit to a branded process, like Agile, for example, and it's many flavors, is you'll run into a situation like you describe And then somebody will suggest something like you describe, and they'll say, well, that's great, but that breaks the sprint. That's not agile. That's
right.
That's not a thing that it wasn't in the book that we read that told us how to work this way. Right. And so inevitably those people exist, right? They exist in every organization. How do you get around that kind of, well, that's not the process kind of feedback?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. Like it's sort of it's the same challenge that we have and that I think that has been talked about a lot more in our community as like as what happens on like when you're debating a feature with a stakeholder, right? And you're like, I put it in front of users and this is what they like. And the stakeholder is like, yeah, but can we still make the button red, right? So so it's not unlike it because a process itself is also a product, right? And so, you know, my initial response to that is like, you're kind of optimizing for the output over the outcome, right? You're being married to the plan. A process is a meta plan, right? It's a plan for how you're going to make a plan of sorts, right? Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah.
And so it's taking this, like all of this, like agile thinking, which is about like staying open to learning more information. And let's say even like agile is more about tech and lean is more about product, right? To use slightly different kind of tactics to illustrate, right? So like if agile is sort of staying open to the fact that like you're going to learn about the code that you're writing as you're writing it, right? And and in lean thinking that you're going to learn more about the problem that you're solving as you're attempting to solve it, right? Taking all of that and then putting it into a rigid planning process is basically taking all of that agile and lean and shoving it into a waterfall box.
Yeah.
That's what that is, right? What I would say to those people is like, that what you're saying is fundamentally unagile. Like I remember we used to talk about it a lot as I think we used to do this at the Ladders too, right? Like the like capital A agile versus lowercase a agile, right? Sure. Like it's not about the capital A agile. In fact, even the original Agile manifesto was like pretty loose. It was a collection of values. It was not a process, right? It was not a do this, then do this, then do this. There was a great desk trainer, a co-founder of Intercom. I just recently heard him give a talk at the Product Leader Summit, where he talked about how they scaled their organization, and in part he talked about the Intercom's process, right? And what was really funny to me is that he starts by belaboring how important it is to have a process, right? Uh-huh. It really is. Like you cannot scale without a process, and then he reveals their process, and their process is 5 steps. Start with a problem, think big, start small, learn fast, deliver outcomes. Again, that's not really a process. That's a set of values.
Yes, values, right? Yeah.
And I would argue that that is in fact the perfect process, right? Because it does encapsulate what you want the team to accomplish in any phase of the planning process, right? Yeah. But you are not stressing the like, well, what does it mean to think big? What is big enough? How big, right?
Right.
It does not say, in order to think big, I want you to get into a room with post-it notes and Sharpies. It doesn't say, in order to think big, I want you to go to our intra-company portal and submit to Idea Central, wherein the ideas will be reviewed by the product team, right? It doesn't say any of that. You might deploy some of those tools as a team. You might be like, hey, why don't we all go up to a whiteboard? Here's a marker to each of you, right? Yeah. Or you might say like, hey, I created a quick Google form. I just want to collect like whatever's on people's minds, right? But so the tools might be different, right? And we're kind of counting on you to be creative enough to come up with a tool that'll solve the problem you're trying to solve. But the process doesn't say specifically what to use. I think like I see a lot of parallels here in terms of creating a planning process. To me is a little bit like saying like we have a user research process, right? So our user research process is not do surveys.
Right.
Like, sure, we do surveys. Like, we in fact do quite a bit of surveys. In fact, some days it feels like surveys is mostly what we do. But like our user research process is not do surveys. Our user research process is deploy whatever tool best allows us to answer the questions that we're asking, right?
Yes.
And now in a planning process, in theory, you're always asking the same question, right? Like, what's the highest impact, lowest effort thing that we could do that delivers maximal value to customers in the business, right?
Yeah.
But actually the questions you're asking anytime you're planning are actually very different, because it's like, hey, do we invest in iteration 17 of this immensely popular product that we have, or do we invest in this like skunk work thing where we're going to try to disrupt ourselves before somebody else does, right? That's a very different decision than the following quarter where you're like, I don't know, if we've got two mature products, do we go to V17 or V18? Do we split the team and do a little bit of each? Those two are very different conversations and need to involve very different people. Like, frankly, whether you're iterating to V17 of some products probably doesn't involve the CEO. But if you're like going to make a plan to potentially pre-disrupt your own product, like the CEO needs to be in on that.
Yeah, for sure. Right? Yeah. So it's interesting, right? So look, one of the biggest challenges that the teams that I work with always have is we need a process for prioritization.
Mm-hmm.
We need to decide, right? And they literally, for better for worse and generally for worse, would be thrilled to have a formula.
Right.
Right. If there are people out there who will give you a formula that spits out a number. And then you can say, well, there's a bigger number, so it's more important, right? And the realities behind all of these formulas, like ICE prioritization and whatever else, like ICE, it is that there's a bunch of just assumptions in there. You make stuff up as much as you would anywhere else.
Yep.
This is the three versus the five or whatever. And so if you're taking the mantra that we started, optimizing for decision making rather than process, right? If a team came to you, and my sense is they do come to you because products, right? They come to you and they say, listen, we need a process for prioritization. Well, what is our process for prioritization?
Yep.
How do you answer that?
Yeah. Well, so I do myself actually like the RICE or slightly modified sort of RICE framework, meaning like I want to understand the reach, impact, complexity, and effort. The reason I say modified is like really what I care about is like I care about impact. In our business model, certainly the impact, the delivering value to the customer correlates very highly with delivering value to the business. So like at least at the knot, I don't find myself debating the like who should win this debate, the customer or the business, right? There's a lot of it's a healthy business model, right? So I care about impact. I care about sort of complexity, effort, right? And then I care about like confidence/risk, right?
Yeah.
And I think what the concept that I think about a lot there is, you know, diminishing returns on further making up accuracy, right? So it's like let's say we're talking about like potentially building something completely new. Like it's a new problem. We're really just starting to understand it, and we're saying things like, you know, as we were talking to customer recently about something, like something new came up, then we started the survey about it. And it turns out like, it looks like maybe 2/3 of our customer base has this problem, right? Like, okay, so 66%. And it's like, nah, somewhere between like, you know, 40 and 70%. It's like, wow, that's a big range, right? It's like, yeah, that's because like, I don't know much about this. Like I ran one survey that wasn't really targeting that. And there was an interesting question at the bottom that drew my attention. And I want to learn more about this, right?
Yeah.
And so versus other times, you do have a situation where it's like, here's a mature product. We understand fully how the system works. We found a point in the conversion funnel that became suboptimal. We know exactly what happened. We know exactly what we want to do. We're going to get 12.5% lift here, right?
Right.
Those are two different levels of confidence, right?
Right. Sure.
To me, the question is sort of like, does increasing the level of accuracy increase really the likelihood that like we're going to make a better decision, right? So if I'm in a place where like, hey, you know what? Like we've got the bandwidth. We do see something interesting here. We're not going to build anything based on like one survey, but like, yeah, absolutely. Like let's carve out some like research time for this and see what that 2/3 is and learn more about it. Like, sure. Let's spend some time on that next quarter. Like maybe that's an easy decision. Right. But maybe I've got several of those. And there's only so many research projects I want to sign up for in a quarter, right? Well, now I'm like, ooh, okay, let me see those surveys. Maybe some of those questions were more tightly written than others. Maybe we do have a tighter band of confidence on some things than others. Can we do a follow-up survey? We've got a few more weeks that we need to commit to OKRs. What can we find out in the next 2 weeks that can increase confidence here?
Yeah. So essentially, what I hear you saying is that
there is definitely a discomfort, right? Like on the stakeholder part, like especially our stakeholders who are closest to like sales and finance, where their team's salaries basically, not salaries, but like their team's like take home money depends on like hitting very specific financial goals, right? Yeah. And then they count on the product team to help them support those, hitting those financial goals. And so there is a very real like tension between, you know, the sales team who needs to put up a number that's like, you know, accurate down to like the decimal point. And then the product team being like, look, we're going to try launching some features. Some of them are going to work. Some of them are not. We think we're going to get a raise between 10 and 20% on this conversion point.
Yeah.
I completely understand why that makes them uncomfortable, right? Because meanwhile, right, they're being asked to make like much more concrete commitments, right? But the thing that I try to explain, and that, you know, that my boss, first of all, tries to explain, and this carries through the product team, is that we can spend another month making shit up that is going to make us feel in our heads like we got a better handle on it and like we understand what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Or you can let me take that month and go talk to some people, build a POC, put it in front of customers, go talk to other companies who have done this, right? Let me go get some real data instead of made up data in our head.
So what I hear you saying, and I just want to make sure and to kind of summarize, is that the way that you optimize for decision-making is by collecting evidence.
Right. Exactly. But also asking ourselves that there is an opposite trap there, where it's like, if there's a very hard decision to make, sometimes people will indefinitely want to gather more evidence.
Right.
So that can be a slippery slope too. It really is the sort of like what could help us make a better decision here? Right. That's sort of the question that you want to ask. Right.
Yeah.
And that's a slippery question. That's why you can't like overly define the process of answering it, right?
I'm going to divert for just a second, because that's super fascinating to me, because yeah, it's a conversation I've been having a lot about lately, is what can help us make a better decision,
mm-hmm,
is an explicit admission by the decision makers that they don't know everything.
Right. Oh yeah. This is a fundamental premise, is that everything that I'm talking about,
yeah,
assumes that you're not the kind of company that needs to have Marty Kagan give it a talk or Jeff Patton give it a talk. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking like entry level, like water. It's 2020, wake up, waterfall still doesn't work. Right.
Right. Yeah.
I'm talking about a company where there is like a great degree of sort of trust placed in the product team. I'm talking about a company where our CPO has, commands a lot of sort of respect among the executives, and who sort of take his guidance and believe him when he says, look, this answer is as accurate as it's going to get until we build a little something. Right. So, you know, for me, who I'm somewhere still in the middle management, right? Like that there is a sort of like, this culture does come from the top and enables all of this. Right.
Yeah.
But has allowed, for example, for me with sort of my peers on the business side to travel that distance from like, you know, the stakeholder kind of being like, no, we need to know exactly how much money it's going to be several quarters ago, to like just earlier, actually just last week, we were going back and forth about some assumptions in our model. And she's like, are you sure about this? And I was like, to be honest, like there's a few assumptions here, and that one I'm not so sure about, but I think what they all add up to, like I'm confident in, right? So like the middle of the funnel is shaky, but like I'm confident in what we're claiming we can do at the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
And she goes, you know what? I agree. And also it won't change what we do over the next 6 months. So it kind of doesn't matter. And it's like, that's really the point, right? Like, how much time do you want to spend planning, and how much time do you want to spend doing? If you got to a point where your decision is as good as it can be for the next 3 months, that's really all you need. Yeah. This also does have to do then with like setting appropriate planning horizons, right? I think that it's much harder maybe in B2B where sort of published roadmaps are the norm. But in B2C, like really, there's no excuse for not tightening to a quarterly OKR schedule. Like, why would you need to plan more than 3 months in advance? Absolutely. Do an annual check-in, like vet the strategy, like have some sense of where the next year is going. But acknowledge that like today, you can't possibly plan for next December.
Yeah. Yeah, that's and I hear you and I agree with you. And it's a really interesting challenge. And, you know, and the quotes have been out there, like Reid Hoffman talked about, if you wait until your product is perfect to launch, you know, you've waited, you've already failed or something. And then Bezos talks about how you can make decisions with 70% of the information because decisions are reversible, right? Yeah. They're two-way doors.
In terms of those sort of like tactics in communication, right? I think the reversible decisions is a big one that we don't talk so much about anymore, but there was a time when we talked about it a lot. And I think now it like kind of seeped in. So we're just not as explicit about it anymore. But like, yeah, is the decision reversible is absolutely a question. Another trick is if you get stuck on trying to compare things based on their value, compare things based on the risk of not doing them. Right. Because sometimes it's easier to imagine the bad things happening. Right. And then often you realize that like the bad thing that happens is like not actually catastrophic at all.
Yes.
you just like really got excited about an idea. But like if you don't do it, like you're not missing any windows of opportunity. You can totally hold on this, learn more about it. Right. Another useful one is to frame it as trade-offs. Right. So I don't know how to explain this phenomenon, but it's as if people who don't work in prod dev see things like research and analysis as like something that doesn't consume any time, right? So it's sort of like, we're gonna keep building stuff that we planned on building. And in addition to that, could you research these 12 really exciting ideas, right? It's like, sure, but not in addition, right? It's a trade-off. We can go spend more time vetting this idea, or you can let us build something that we've already vetted, or you can let us build something because that's going to help us vet the idea that you just got excited about. Yeah, like that's work. You know.
Yeah, it's the thing that people like they don't realize that's actual work. Like there's somebody has to take time and do that research.
Exactly, and I think that like framing things as like ROI positive or negative generally does resonate with stakeholders. Like it's and it is a genuine reframing. Like I'm not trying to fool anybody. It really is me saying like I can ask one of my PMs to go spend another week crunching data and making up assumptions, or I can ask them to go build a POC and put it in front of customers. Yeah, right? Exactly. Like that's those are the options. And similarly, again, to up level it, right? Like let's say we're actually right now discussing our Q4 OKRs, right? And there's some like juicy debates that we would like to have, but then we took a look at it and we realized, oh, wait a minute, like because of this, that, and the other thing, we're actually not going to be able to do some of these things just like as a matter of practical issue. And so what's the point of debating? Like, sure. Would it be a satisfying debate? Yes. Do you want to have it over a beer and a happy hour? Maybe.
Yeah.
But like, don't do work you don't need to do. Like, we all already have too much on our plates.
Yeah. That's excellent. I used to have I knew a guy in college who that's all he wanted to do was just debate stuff all the time. It was exhausting.
Look, it's fun, but yeah.
Sure, it can be fun. But
that is also, at the same time, like that is sort of the essence of so, you know, I was telling you, Des's process is like, you know, like start with the problem, think big, start small, learn fast. My quarterly OKR planning process is get inputs, document the consideration set, debate, and then have the final document of like alignment and commitment.
Yeah,
that's it. And so it's like, again, it's like a very fuzzy process, and everything that matters happens in the debate step. It's where you get in front of your stakeholders and you say things like, I think I can move this number by this much. And they're like, can you do it by more? Or they're like, I don't believe it.
Yeah.
Or they come to you and they say, can you double this number for me? And you say, well, here's a couple of user problems that I'm aware of. And I think that they add up to about half of what you're asking for. I can't find you the other half.
Yeah. Huh. Which look, is fair. And then of course, you're going to have some of those CEOs be like, get me double.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think, yeah, the part that I'm completely skirting so far in this conversation is like, you know, what if you're not working with the right team of people?
Yeah, yeah, no. And listen, and I hear you. There's a reason why, look, and there's a reason why you're...
It just feels like a whole separate topic, you know,
course,
like
that's... And yes, but look, it sounds, and from what I know, like you're working in a fairly mature and enlightened organization. And that's, yeah, and that's exactly the kind of conversation that I'm interested in having, which is great. So look, I've got one more question for you, which I'm curious about, and then we can wrap this up. And my question is this. So if we're optimizing our process for decision-making, mm-hmm, and we are making decisions, we're making better decisions by prioritizing the collection of evidence,
mm-hmm,
how do we build without a recipe book,
mm-hmm,
right? Without the Scrum guide or whatever, you know, a fancy diagram from the SAFe folks. How do we build consistency across teams and departments in the organizations, or do we need to?
Right. So that's, I'm pausing because I feel like this for me has been sort of an evolution of thinking. I used to put a lot of emphasis on consistency. And I thought it was the hallmark of like doing things well. And I think it like comes to us a little bit from like child and school psychology, because like that's, and it, you know, sort of draw some correlation to like a manager being sort of like a teacher and a mentor, a good one anyway, hopefully, right? And that like really consistency matters above all, right? But I'm not so sure about that anymore. So my answer is that I don't know, but I am starting to think that maybe consistency is overrated, right? So I think like I'd much rather, or rather the kind of consistency that I think matters is again fuzzy, right? I think like consistency of rigor is really interesting, right? So mm-hmm, what I would hate to have is two teams where one of them has like vetted and debated and looked at data and been honest with themselves about what they know, what they don't know, where they're putting finger in the air and saying, this would just make sense, but let's write it in red font so that we remember we made it up, right? and then have a second team that's like, this feels right. I don't know, it makes sense to me, right? So like that you wouldn't want to have, right? So you want to have some consistency of rigor. But like, what if you have a team that's starting something greenfield and a team that's like optimizing a very mature product? Like, should they really follow the same process? The greenfield team should spend most of their days talking to customers. The mature products team should have regular check-ins with the customers, but actually spend a lot more time in those like, you know, data analysis and like looking for those like micro hacks where you're like tweaking the last 0.5% out of your conversion funnels, right? Yeah. It the day-to-day does look different.
Yeah, yeah. And
the planning process looks different. There's in the greenfield area, you're like, all of this is very low confidence, but some of these things are going to give us 2x and some of these things are going to give us 4x. So let's prioritize the 4x things, right?
Yeah.
And then the mature team is like, I'm not so sure this is going to be a 0.5% lift. I think 0.75 is totally realistic, right?
Yeah.
Like completely different levels of confidence and qualities of decision. But in the sense that like, you know, the consistency I'm interested in is that like, you made the highest quality decision with the data that was available.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really great. That's really great. And I forgot what I was going to say next. I had a good question, but I forgot it. But that was, yeah, I mean, look, I remember now. Maybe it comes down to the process is, you need to tell me a compelling story.
Right.
Right. And right. So if you're doing greenfield stuff, tell me a compelling story about why you think this is the vision for the greenfield thing that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're making micro tweaks in a mature product, well, tell me a compelling story about why you think we should be tweaking here and not there.
Totally. But the stories are just going to look very different, right? So like the greenfields, and that's why even again, like, so templates are notoriously parts of a process, right? And it's very interesting to be having this conversation with you right now, because I feel like I am literally just sort of in this period of evolving my thinking around a lot of this stuff, right? Like I'm not going to lie, I like templates. They provide you a framework, they set an expectation for what the reader expects, right? But you very quickly have to break a template, right? Like it really, what it does is it communicates expectation to you about the general structure of the story. And then you still have to find a way to make it work for you, because the template for the micro-optimization story is frankly a spreadsheet. Show me the math. There's a ton of data. It's a mature product. We have years of evidence about what has or has not moved the needle, what has or has not worked. Like there's no making anything up. Like let's just look at a spreadsheet, right? If you tried to shove a greenfield story into a spreadsheet, it would just force you to make up a bunch of things that look way more confident than you actually are. The appropriate story for greenfield, to the degree it follows the same story, the same format as the other one, is something like, this is the impact we think we can drive. This is the level of complexity we would embark on. And this is how confident we are. But then the rest of the story is like, let me introduce you to Julie. She's planning a wedding.
No, that's perfect. That's excellent. Listen, Selena, this was fantastic. Really great. Really great stuff. And I think it really drives home the point that true agility means breaking the templates, and it means adjusting the processes based on context, based on the life cycle of your of the place in the life cycle where your product is at the moment, and kind of the kind of story you need to tell. And I think that that's a huge win. So so thank you. Thanks for that.
I think there's a sort of, this is a slight tangent, right? But there is sort of, I have this like sort of quasi-philosophical musing also, that I think that there's like things like process, things like templates, things like consistency. We as a society value, Western society value, and it kind of dovetails with our desire for a consistent narrative, but a consistent narrative is uncomfortably often at odds with finding true kernels of truth. And to build winning products, you need to find actual truth of user needs and desires and willingness to overcome an obstacle to use a product or get the value that you're promising. And I think that the sometimes we fall in the trap of like that desire for narrative can actually obfuscate the kernels of truth. And the kernels of truth very often frustratingly do not add up to a satisfying narrative.
Yes. And that's really, that's, look, you don't want to end up as the product manager who weaves a story out of pieces that don't fit together,
Exactly.
right? Like, and that's it. Like, that's
But
maybe that's the
I
hallmark
think
of a really talented product manager as well, right? Is to say, and again, it comes back to humility. So, look, we did the research, we learned all this stuff. I don't know.
exactly. It's sort of it's like making the investment in learning how to tell a compelling story. With that story, including a bunch of like, we don't know and we're not sure, but the way we reason about it is, because that also creates something for other people to engage with, right? Like if I make up a model, let's say I'm looking at a greenfield thing, right? And I'm making a bunch of assumptions, but I write down an Excel model and I share that with somebody. That model looks to them as black on white as any other model they've seen. And they're like, oh, you're telling me you can make us 20 million here? This is amazing. I'm totally going to approve this project,
I mean,
right? But like, no, really the way I should present that model is like, it should be a paragraph. Like, hey, so here's what I'm thinking, right? Like, here are the things we know, bold numbers. Here are the things that I suspect. Like, I bet you, given that we were able to convert a third of this market, I bet you we can capture at least a quarter of this market. It might take us a couple of years. But like, now that's a narrative. That's not a model. And the recipient can clearly see, A, this is not yet a model. And B, they can engage with the assumptions that I'm making in a way that are not as clear in a spreadsheet.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So presentation matters, right? And look, narrative is fundamentally different than spreadsheet, and you're appealing to different parts of the personality, the brain, the motivation, et cetera. So amazing. Cool. This was great. Thank you very much.